A cat told me it's a beautiful thing. You know the communist school teachers, when he got, this chick told me this last night, that the guy got this carried away. He said, this is a man of importance. If it was communist school, I'd rather have a child molester teach my kid. He really got out of it, right? That's completely whacked out. That's it. Oh, I went to that a little earlier. That's it. Thank you, though. Is that beautiful? There's no concept of it. I said to my friend, I said, get me a Life magazine because I want to maybe do a bit on it because I saw a pictorial thing on Jewish and Goyish. There's your life. It's Fig Newtons. They're Jewish. Insurance is very goyish. Insurance for investment is a slap you should get slapped in the face for. Yeah, that's a good. Don't say investment. Just say like you better take your bread away for you. Do it away. Sano, that's atheist. Sano is like out of it. I don't know anybody that smokes Sano. This is heavy goyish. TV dinners. Whoo, that's it. That's it. That's a good tester. Babe Ruth. That's goyish, but Jews eat it to have things to kvetch about. You know? You're going to fill yourself full of that crap and that poison? And that's it. That's what Babe Ruth is, a crap and poison. Here it is, Chef Boyardee. That's it. Okay. That's the thing, like, don't lay no language. That's something like some old fae who wants to be hip and go, look, I dig the bop and a joke. You like Earl Garner? Yeah, he's very talented. So it's the same thing as like the Italian, like, once again, that's the most gorgeous time. Mamma mia, I like Chef Boyardee. You know, the Italians are really throwing up, man. Mamma mia, much a boy. That's, what the hell dialect that is there? Baby, you're a firework. Come on, show them what.
We're not supposed to talk about Star Trek on this show. We've had technical difficulties result from it in the past.
Yeah, see? Okay, I won't talk about Star Trek.
Just kidding. Tell us about the soap.
No, that was the whole point, is that Gene Roddenberry understood that their show had to sell soap, and then in the meantime, he could, like, elaborate his, you know, tell us stories and hopefully people would enjoy it or get it or whatever. But the first thing that had to happen was soap sales. Or
is that why they
Pepsi
have all those
sales.
Episodes about germs?
Maybe. But you know, the other really, you know, you'd want to talk about capitalism run amok was in the 80s, how they would put product placement in the movies, like Pepsi Free in Back to the Future. And over the years, Back to the Future has become one of my favorite sync stories, sync movies. And I don't think that when they made it, it was ever intended to be anything cosmic like I perceive it now. But and it's only because of personal syncs. Like I'm living next to a clock right now, and the clock tower happened to stop clanging a week ago when we had a lightning storm. Just weird shit like that. But it resonates for me on a level that transcends the bullshit capitalist product placement that's all over that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's weird.
I'm with you. I mean, I think this is the, you know, in one respect, if we're going to deal with media, this is our challenge, right? Like, we could be syncing with, you know, classic Russian literature if we wanted to, but, you know, this community is focusing on pop culture, and this is the challenge of it, is how do we, and honestly, even if we did classic Russian literature, you're dealing with someone else's point of view. I had someone years ago, I was wearing a Tom Petty t-shirt at I went to like a political event. I was wearing a Tom Petty t-shirt. Someone was like, you know what Tom Petty's political affiliation is? I was like, I don't fucking care. I was like, I really don't fucking care. I was like, I read Kurt Vonnegut books. I think he's one of the great writers out there, but I disagree with his political message to a large extent. So I'm like, I'm able to appreciate the artistry of it, and I don't have to then be convinced by his argument to appreciate his artistry. So if, you know,
back to Trump Petty's political message.
I think that person was just trying to be like a douchebag and just saying, like, if you're supporting something, you know what you're supporting.
By the way, wear a Rage Against the Machine shirt. It's all, then you know what the politics is. It just doesn't matter what the song sucks.
So it's like, you know, I we're gonna take this to Ishmael for a second, because in Ishmael, I wasn't completely, like, this is, I think, has always been my political problem, is, well, I agree with someone when they say, this is the problem, and we're all on the same, and I'm on the same page as them. And then the minute someone goes, and this is the solution, it's like saying, I found the truth, and I'm like, well, I don't know if I really think that's the solution. And that's been my issue with Vonnegut and every political writer I've ever read. And with Ishmael, it was the same thing. I didn't agree with all of his points, but what I thought was so fascinating is that here you are deriding Ishmael as this plastic thing. The whole point of the book, he keeps saying, is that culture is telling you, is selling you this lie, and the ultimate message of culture is to consume. And you're saying, it's like, you can have someone, the point is, it's the whole fucking point of the book, is, hey, you're being sold a fucking lie. From the moment you're born, culture is telling you, buy their shit, consume everything. And if you're going to say, that's the plastic thing, when that catches on, and again, it's not in total defense of that book, I'm asking, like, so what, how fucking Rage Against the Machine to get for you to, like, that legitimate artistic statement of, I mean, those are the words that I could grab the book off my shelf right now and read you, is saying culture is telling you a lie since you're born, telling you just to consume everything, and that's repeated every few pages. How much more in your face does someone have to say that for you to feel like it's not plastic?
I guess for me, when I was exposed to the book, I was like, you didn't get that message like 5 years ago. Like, I thought we've moved on to something more complicated at this point. That's just where I was at as a pretty obnoxious, I might still be, but freshman in college, you know? That was just my viewpoint on it at that stage of my life. I was just like, people were holding it up like as this amazing accomplishment. You got to read Ishmael. I'm like, what? This is not what we should be excited about at this point in our lives. We should be into some deeper territory. That was just, that's where I was at when I was a freshman in college. So my point is, you know, okay, something is worthy of value in a Nicki Minaj song. Big fucking deal. We need to be studying.
But you never read Ishmael?
I didn't.
You never read it?
I didn't.
You're talking about what people recommended as something and the Philistine prophecy. Did you ever read the Philistine prophecy?
About 2.5 pages before I put it down.
Well, see, that's the thing. You can't judge something.
Not 2.5 pages, 2.5 chapters. You know, 2.5 chapters. It's like,
but still, if you have can't judge something based on, you can't take apart something and look at it as if it were the whole. And even so, like, you're not saying it has ultimate value, but does that mean it has no value? I mean, that's a question of art too. If art doesn't have ultimate value, is it completely valueless?
And David, can I just challenge you for a second? I agree with, I think you're raising an excellent point, so I don't want to discourage that. But when you said you can't take a part of something and see it as a whole, isn't that what Sink does?
Well, yeah, you're recognizing how the whole is contained within the part. But and you will never see the whole of anything. And like, and it's not about like what the, like, this is the thing I love about Sink, is that it's not even about what the artist intended at a certain point. It's what you're getting out of it. And so, like, I mean, that's what I found with Kubrick. I think Kubrick is a genius, and I think some of the biggest insights that I've gotten out of Kubrick, chances are he didn't, that wasn't in, like, he set it up so that you could go there with it, but he wasn't aware of all these things in the same way that we are. Does that make sense?
100%. And that's the value of the intention put into the work, I think. That, like you said, Kubrick constructed and designed his films in a way that lend themselves to huge insights divorced, like mutually exclusive from his creation, but yet they're entangled within. That's a perfectly...
David's saying that he finds that in Lady Gaga.
I do.
I'm saying...
I'll watch Lady Gaga, The Fame Monster with Metropolis, an infinite number of times, and I won't fucking get tired of it. Because I've always seen new things. I'm like, that's deep. And the level of what it's communicating is totally profound. And I believe that she did it intentionally because there's just too much there. It went over that threshold of like, this doesn't just happen. And I love that about it. You know, that on a certain level could take away from it, the fact that I think it was intentional. But at the same time, it shows that the artist has more value than we even realize. Like, we're judging Marilyn Manson on all of these points, and I'll hear everyone's opinion about Marilyn Manson, but then when I discover Holy Wood and Holy Mountain and the fact that I can't see how that couldn't be intentional, I'm like, wow, that's really awesome that you could go to that much trouble for something that he doesn't even give a fuck if the public is aware of. Like, he's not doing it for recognition, he's doing it to do it because it's fucking creative, and it's awesome.
Well, that killed the conversation.
I'm just processing. It's cool. I'm nodding here.
That's when you know that that you got a really good sync, that all the sync heads just sit back and ruminate on that.
Yeah. Lady Gaga leaves clues like O.J. Simpson. She doesn't, like, there's no, nothing's like hidden. You just follow the points. And so there's three albums that go with three films, and I believe all of them are intentional. And I could back that up, and I could show it. I've shown it to people, and everybody I've shown them to has been like, yeah, I can't really argue with that. And so that's fucking interesting on one level, but then at the same time, it's like, how many people are listening to this and have no idea? And that gives another level of that adds something to it, you know, the fact that that many people could be paying attention to something and yet not hearing it. Or not seeing what it's communicating. And it's out of context. You know, you're listening to it in a different context. I showed my rabbi Metropolis and The Fame Monster, and I told him afterwards that this girl is popular. He doesn't listen to any pop culture, anything. He doesn't know who anybody is. And he couldn't believe that was popular because he saw it only in that context. He saw it for its Kabbalistic value and couldn't imagine how that could interest anybody. But meanwhile, no one else sees, or not no one else, but most people do not recognize the Kabbalistic value of her work, you know?
But isn't that like going to church and looking around at how many people there don't even know what they're taught? Like, they're just going through the motions at, you know, you go to any church anywhere in America and people are just going through the motions, and then maybe there's five people there who are taking it to that level. Or is that just a judgment, you know, but I guess my point is, like, right. It's like, is there to some level, you can't, you know, of course we would want, or would we want, I shouldn't, again, it's a loaded comment, are you getting upset that, is it something you get upset about, that, you know, 99% of the people listening to a Lady Gaga song are just dancing, or maybe, and that could even be just a truly embodied experience of it, and they're not just intellectualizing it. Or is it that you want, is your goal to bring the other 99% into a full conscious understanding of the artist?
Upon the hill. It's only
right,
about secrecy. It sucks, but that's what adds to it. That's the art. It's a weird thing. I've had to reconcile that, and I'm still continuing to reconcile that phenomenon of how secrecy itself is a part of the art. like, eventually, I mean, I take that as the meaning in Dark Side of the Moon when they say, and if there is no room upon the hill, because if everybody jumps in on the fucking, on the thing, on the meat of the biscuit, then it ceases to be what it was. It's no longer a serpent anymore. It's something else. You get what I'm communicating?
Absolutely. And I think this is the interesting thing for me. It's like, do you need the book, you know, for, does everyone need to get it? Or like, I guess I'm trying to understand what the, and again, we're talking on like five different levels at once here. So on one level, I totally sympathize with Bill's argument that I get anything out of a Katy Perry song. Doesn't do anything for me artistically, spiritually, anything. But I'm sure if I put my intent on it and tried to see something in it, I could. You asked, so if you can say that the meaning of life is found in Nicki Minaj's songs, so what? I mean, I've made this argument before, like the only value of that, and this is such a profound truth, and yet we're at a point where we're like, so what? It's like, you can show that everything is connected, that you can find God in anything. So, you know, every time Jake Kotzen puts out a new video and demonstrates this, for us following this work for years, or who do this on a daily basis, there can be days where you're like, okay, and so what? But it's, we're almost like, you know, you have your Gnostic experience, and God says, the meaning of life is this. And you're like, yeah, and is there anything more? Like, there are days where we can be so blasé about profound truths. I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is, what is you really upset about? Are you upset about that people are buying Coca-Cola?
What I'm building,
or upset that a community is that a community, a quasi-spiritual community is focusing on pop culture garbage. Like, what is?
Why do you think marijuana is on the cusp of being legal in the United States of America?
Because we now have the Patriot Act, and you don't need to have drugs to be illegal to criminalize people. You can just criminalize people for their thoughts.
That's one angle.
And they figured out how to make money from it.
To make money from it and destroy California's number one cash crop. No, that would be such a fucking tragedy if that wasn't done right. Like,
it's totally mafia move. It's like, you know, the CIA's been dealing drugs for, you know, decades, but it's like, hey, here's all these other guys who are making money off on the black market. We could make some of that. We could make more of that money.
Far more. Yeah.
So wait, but Bill, I guess the point is, there's a lot of reasons, but what was the reason you were going for?
Well, I'm thinking that it's just not dangerous enough. It's not a dangerous, boundary-dissolving, questioning substance that could give power structures a headache. Marijuana played a key role in the 60s. You know, most 60s bands were vocally or subliminally, or, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, advertising marijuana use, you know, an illegal activity. When marijuana is legal, can you imagine what kind of artists are going to be shills for, you know, Dope Boys pot brownies? You know, they're going to tour sponsoring, you know, Coca-Cola's new green Coca-Cola Green with cannabis in it. I mean, there's something to be recognized in this evolution. I don't know.
But just because something can be co-opted doesn't mean that it's, you know, you don't throw the baby out bathwater. I mean, again, you're sounding, I mean this as friendly as possible, but you're sounding more and more like Jan Urban to me. It's like,
wow.
Yes, Ken.
I don't know about that.
Holy shit, dude. My God.
Really? Really? Like, you know, just because someone could have, and I'm not denying that, like, when you ask why is marijuana being legal, yes, there's a financial aspect, there's a pacifying aspect. I think it's definitely a control move. I don't think it's particularly good for us. And there are other levels in which it would be nice to be socially acceptable. And
I gotta tell you, living in Washington State is pretty awesome. I got caught out in the a guy in my library parking lot yesterday. He was sitting out on a park bench. It was, you know, twilight, and neither of us was paranoid. And the guy looked like a freak. It was awesome. It was just like,
I agree, man. It's awesome. It's like, it's so great to have that paranoia be gone.
But we've discussed this before. What was it about the paranoia that was beneficial, if there was anything beneficial at all? Anyone?
Well,
you're doing something against the grain, which always feels good. Makes you actually feel like you really are a counterculture. But at the same time, I would love to see it legal. I would just only like to see it if it was done in the right way. And I don't think that that's going to be offered anytime too soon. So.
Right. I mean, I used to work with these like libertarians, and it was so funny to me when I started hearing people say, marijuana should be, if it was first, it was marijuana should be decriminalized. And then I started hearing people saying, yeah, just like alcohol or tobacco, you legalize it and tax it and regulate it like you do alcohol and tobacco. And I'm like, whoa, I thought you're just talking libertarians here. Why are you taxing or regulating? Like, don't most libertarians don't like taxes or regulation? So my point here is, like, I don't want to hand over marijuana power to Coca-Cola or the government. So I'm with you, David. It's like, it's about how it's done, I think, is a somewhat of a nuanced position here. It's like, yeah, I don't want to have the fear of going to jail for doing something that I don't think is particularly dangerous. And at the same time, you know, to hand it over to Coca-Cola to make that happen seems kind of fucked up as well.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I mean, so we've gone through music, we've gone through film, now we're on something that is a plant that grows in the ground that makes people happy. And I think what we can all agree on is that if it happens in America, we're going to find a way to fuck it up to make money off it. Then at that point, you don't blame the artist, the director, the plant. You say that is an American phenomenon.
We are a capitalist, and
it's toxic, and there's all these negative things about it. But it's like we're in that toxic ocean. There's no purity that exists inside of this toxic ocean. I mean, you can try and find it. You can try and argue that somehow Pink Floyd or the Beatles are more righteous than Katy Perry, and that Beethoven is more righteous than, you know, than the Beatles and Pink Floyd. But by the time they get to American shows, I guarantee we're going to try and sell Coca-Cola using that. If people will look at it or smoke it or listen to it or gather to be excited about it, we in America will sell you a t-shirt with that on it. That's what America is about. It's sad. It's, you know, and you can try and have a revolution. But going out there,
and if you don't buy the
musician, seems like it's missing the point.
Right.
And if you don't buy the t-shirt, we'll bomb you.
I was reading.
Actually, if you don't buy the t-shirt, we'll find someone else's t-shirt you'll buy, and we'll just stop paying attention to that person.
Right.
We're going to keep selling you. It's not that we're going to bomb you if you don't buy the t-shirt. We are going to find the t-shirt you will buy, and we will sell it to you. And we'll make sure that it's, you know, that all of the business that goes into making that t-shirt, the chemicals that feed the cotton and the industries make the ink and all that stuff. It's just, it's a big game to sell textiles.
Yeah.
And whether it's the Beatles on it or Katy Perry, you know, the artist, I guess what you might say is that, and I'm not a Katy Perry fan. So that's why I'm using her. at least you could, Katy Perry sort of goes into it as a, you know, as an American to just make money, whereas, and there's no hypocrisy to it, whereas the Beatles go into it to do some, you know, with the idea of doing something more righteous, and ultimately they're just still selling lunch boxes.
Well, they were manufactured, and then they had to communicate things subtextually, especially initially. So they were being put out in this position where everyone was counting on them to make them money, literally, and to they wanted them to be huge. There was a huge invested interest in this band being fucking huge. And so anything that they did, it seems like initially there was very little freedom, and there really never was ultimate freedom. Like, and that's why you'll see so much, like, little, like, they had to go under the radar when they wanted to communicate. Like, you listen to, like, Come Together, it's obviously about a three-way. Anyone can hear that that fucking song's about a three-way. Come Together Right Now Over Me. I mean, seriously, like, he's diseased, you know? Like, it's so fucking obvious. Yet, if it was outright, it would never have gotten radio play.
Did you know the song was actually written as a campaign song for Timothy Leary's gubernatorial run in California?
Yeah, they love double, triple meanings. They use them all the time. Pink Floyd did, too. It's like, it's, you know, I mean, you can't say what the thing is about. Hey Jude, that was code for heroin, according to my mom in the 60s in San Francisco. She's like, Jude, like, if you, like, you know, the minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to feel better that was all about heroin and their experience with heroin. It's a heroin song. Like, but that got fucking radio play. Like, I'm just making the point that, and even if you don't agree with these examples, you can't really, I mean, the Beatles used, like, this subtextual method more and more as they grew. And they were given more freedom, it seems. But, like, Hold My Hand, like, how fucking manufactured can you get? I have a book, like a Saint Germain book on alchemy, and I was, like, halfway through it. And this book was written in the 60s or maybe early 70s or something. And it was like, it made the point. It was like, Mozart was music of the spheres. The Beatles, specifically in the Saint Germain book, it says, is not the music of the spheres. So avoid the Beatles. And I'm like, what the fuck is he saying? Everything's the music of the spheres. Otherwise, it wouldn't be the music of the spheres. Like, that seems so obvious.
So, but this dovetails into, in my
DuckTale?
Yeah, right. This is what I think is the major theme of Philip K. Dick's writings, is the whole notion of the replicant and of Valis, which is a laser beam that is communicating a false reality. And is that possible? Sure. And that was what his fear was. And,
well, it's always been happening, though. That's the nature of the cleat boat, right? It's a replica. It's a substitute reality. And we've been living in a substitute reality since, like Michael said, Edison, I think, was your example.
Well, actually, the fall of man, which back several thousand years.
Right. But
the technology,
as far as our culture that we're familiar with, as we're relating to it and the context in which we're speaking here, sure. But yeah, we've got this fucking substitute reality we've been living with ever since we've been objectifying each other, you know?
But is there a way to see through to the real reality? And
sure,
once you do see through to the real reality, what is your emotional connection to the agencies that would seek to continue to blind or continue to occlude people, especially when they start co-opting certain pseudo-spiritual messages within their works?
Well, they become aids. You see them for what they are, and if they're a mode of self-reflection.
So, like, okay, here's a perfect example. Everyone know that restaurant Chick-fil-A?
Mm-mm. Oh, yeah.
Okay, would anyone here eat at Chick-fil-A?
Not if it was the last Chick-fil-A on Earth.
Exactly. And so when I watch college football and I see on primetime television on Saturday night, the main sponsor of that college football game is Chick-fil-A, and the little cow pops his head up and it says, eat more chicken, I really want to erase it where it says the cow is holding a sign that says God hates fags. Because really, what is the corporate underpinning of that organization? And why is Chick-fil-A...
My reason for not eating at Chick-fil-A is because I don't want to eat fast food, genetically modified and hormone-filled crap. I don't really care about their political beliefs.
Kind of like a Katy Perry song, right? That's why I don't know a single Katy Perry song.
What does Katy Perry sing?
I mean, I can boycott Chick-fil-A because it's homophobic. You know, their political views are homophobic. I boycott them because for the same reason Alan boycotts them. But you know, and it would be more, you know, like what if there was something that I really, really liked, spinach was like homophobic and I couldn't eat spinach, you know, or something like that. It would have to be a real choice. But,
well, Popeye the Sailor Man, you know, he eats the spinach and then the, battleship appears on his arm. Is spinach promoting the military industrial complex?
Well, it's like big tobacco. It's like big tobacco. If you didn't learn in 1999 that, let's put it this way. Let's say they legalize pot. But for some reason, Marlboro pot sells more than anybody else's. But then you figure out that they genetically engineered their marijuana to be more addictive, especially when you smoked it. So not only were people smoking more Marlboro pot, but they were dying of cancer in their 60s. But they never told you that they genetically engineered their pot. Well, this is what happened in the 90s when they found out that the reason why the big tobacco companies sold more tobacco is that they genetically engineered plants to be more addictive and thus making them more carcinogenic and more dangerous. That's why I stopped smoking big tobacco, because these corporations designed poison to be put into people's bodies without telling them. I mean, it's just like, boom, you're gone. I can't do it.
How do you explain American Spirits being one of the most dominating tobacco brands, yet the substance that's in tobacco that's the most addictive, prior to popular belief that it's nicotine, actually contains the least and is also the most popular cigarette? Sugar is the most addictive thing in tobacco. It's sucrose, so it's the chemical equivalent of sugar.
Transparency.
Yeah, trying to research different tobacco alternatives. You know how many, it was really hard for me to find a tobacco that didn't have high fructose corn syrup in it.
Right. For real.
Kind of fucking crazy.
No, they do. And that's the whole joke of like Nicorette and all this shit. Nicotine's out of your system in 3 days. Everyone's addicted to sugar. It's the same thing with alcohol. We were acting like it has something to do with all this other shit. And it's like, no, that's what they're veiling is the secret in plain sight, which is fucking sugar. And I wasn't able to quit tobacco after years of smoking until I realized that. Because I was like, after 3 days, what is this fucking jitter? Like, beyond like the oral fixation and the social aspect, what is this fucking addiction? And I'm like, oh, it's the sugar. And so you drink a fucking smoothie. And I'm like, oh, that's eased. It's like, oh, now I'm like totally, I'm just aware of that. And actually, Marlboro bought American Spirit, and I don't know what they're at now, but back when I looked up all the different amounts of sucralose or sucrose or whichever it is, the sugar equivalent, and what you're saying, high fructose corn syrup, literally, your lungs take it in just like your digestive system would, and American Spirit was the least of all the brands, and yet they were one of the most highest selling because people want it. I mean, it's still genetically modified. Actually, friends of mine who are smokers got an argument with representatives of American Spirit because they're saying it's natural. And they smoked American Spirit, and they're like, it is genetically modified. And the people were like, no, we don't know what you're talking about. And they're like, do you really not know what we're talking about? Are you fucking with us? Are you like, do you really not know? Or are you just saying you don't know? And they got in a big debate because they're like, your tobacco is genetically modified because you just admit that. Because if you ever smoke regular tobacco that's had nothing done to it, it's harsh. It's intense. You know, like I've had it. I like it, but it's like, whoa, you can feel it in your stomach, you know? Anyways, another subject.
Yeah, you actually smoke a lot less. When you smoke the real, you smoke a lot less.
Shit, yeah, you can't smoke more. You'll
fucking right, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Don't laugh at your cigarettes, yeah. Well, we live in, I think...
was about to say something. We sort of jumped on it. We were going down the tobacco road.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Bill?
Oh, I think David said it all right there.
Oh, okay.
It's toasted. Hey! Oh, man. I What is up with the pyramid thing and tobacco and, like, the crazy, like, occult symbols? I guess it's just like it is in everything, but... Wow. I was just looking at it the other day. I was looking at a pack of Camels, and I was looking at the fact that there's like some generic brand just called Pyramid. It's like, bro, mm-hmm. It's just like, they don't care.
You know, it's funny, we were supposed to do this in the future, but we're talking about tobacco, and we're talking about advertising, and we're talking about the sort of corrupting and co-opting influence of America and American advertising, and I just can't help but feel like we're teetering right on our Mad Men conversation that we've been threatening to have for a while.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that is a show that really, again, it's a how about that? So it's a show that is selling us stuff by making fun or sort of looking at the dark side of selling stuff. I mean,
yeah.
America is sneaky. The thing is, it's, and you sort of have to be sneaky to be an artist in it. I think like an artist like Matthew Weiner who created Mad Men. Look, you're going to make a TV show. You can make, either way, you're going to have to do something that's corrupt and corrupting because the nature of American media is going to be, you know, if you want to be a success, then you're going to be selling fashion or selling stuff.
Well, it's funny. I think more people watch the show Dexter than the show Mad Men, right? But
I don't know if that's true.
I think so. I'd like to see the numbers on that. But you know, Dexter is about a serial killer. That's more fiction than the sort of semi-serial killing that's going on in Mad Men. You know.
Ooh, I just found a picture of, I wonder, this is from someone's blog. They have the layout of Don Draper's tarot reading, which I was looking, I wrote them all down and I couldn't find my paper. I misplaced where I wrote it, but she emphasizes the world card in his bring to, which I don't know if you heard little spiel on what I found in Mad Men to do with the Babylon working.
No, I haven't heard that.
I don't know.
No, it's not me.
So there's this whole thing where I'm like, okay, Don Draper is Dick. What's his last? Whatever
Whitman.
It is. Whitman.
Halloran.
Okay.
Dick Whitman.
And so when you know he's born of a prostitute in the episode where it shows. You know, that him being born right after his mother shouts, I'm going to burn your dick in pig fat. You remember that? She says, speaking to Dick Whitman's father, she says, I'm going to burn your dick in pig fat, literally direct quote. Right afterwards, the the woman who aided with the birth, I forget what you call them, but she brings the
midwife.
The midwife brings the baby to the father, and she says his name is Dick. Okay, so you can see the symbolism in the whole rest of the show of literally his father's dick being him being burned in pig fat. So his whole life, he's being burned in pig fat. And so he's also, there's the continual references to the maypole throughout it where they show the women dancing around the maypole. The maypole is literally the phallus. And there's a scene where he's looking at the maypole and they do this whole like it's not subtle. Like if you're paying attention, like he is the maypole, and all of those women that he's getting it on with are literally the women that encircle and entwine the phallus. And so, and then this explains, and I think it's season two, there's the Babylon episode where the last scene is with the two pillars and he's standing between them. And there's a whole, do you remember that? Like, but they're talking about Zionism, and she's all like, oh, Zionism just means it's in the Bible, read the Bible, you know, this whole bit. And so every episode ends with the Sun card where it says Wiener Brothers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see the symbolism of the Sun card being obviously the phallus, but the World card is the one that when they give this tarot reading in the show, she picks up the woman, Anne, picks up the World, and she says, this is you. This is what you're all about. So you can see the hermaphrodite in the World card with the four cherubim, but that placement of that card is between Yesod and Malkut on the Tree of Life, which is the foreskin. And so literally the dick being burned in the pig oil is literally his fucking foreskin. So which is a covenant. It's just the symbol is very direct. He's like, you're this. So and that's the klipo. And so literally he's burning up the fucking klipo around his father's dick.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Are we going into Mad Men now?
You don't have to keep going. I just wanted to drop this on Andros because.
Well, I mean, that sounds great. I've never seen an episode, so I don't have anything to add. And,
I've also never seen an episode.
So I mean, fascinating, but
It just seemed like, I mean, first of all, I'd say if you find this conversation interesting, you should watch that show. And it's just that because the themes that we're discussing are, it's right there. The question of, like, if you watch the show, it's like how they relate to cultural movements in that show and how those cultural movements, I mean, they're advertisers. So they, I mean, from the standpoint of, and I'll agree with Bill that, you know, I think advertisers are the enemy. I mean that from the standpoint of as an artist who's trying to get across a message, the advertisers are the enemy. And an audience trying to see the message, the advertisers are the enemy. So, because they're the ones who are fussing with the art with no concern for its content or its context, just how hot it is, right?
Right.
So I just think that's a show that is exploring the enemy, using the enemy to explore itself.
Right.
Right. It's kind of a mirror, and in that way, it could be considered very subversive.
Yeah, it's also subversive in the way that they're showing that how the esoteric. Is as it ceases to be esoteric as things are shown to people, it's the same mechanism that's at work in advertising and sigil magic. And so when you have a sigil, you have a logo, and then you're putting power into the logo, the act of what they're doing is the same thing that the magician does. And that seems to be the whole point of a large point of what's being communicated.
And you see this in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake with how often advertisements invade the dreamer's dream. You know, in the dream, the dreamer is trying to reconcile very deep personal issues, resolving his past, present, and future. But it's like every couple of sentences, some fragment of an advertisement or a television or a radio program invades his dream and takes him off into distant places so that he can avoid the matter at hand. And there's whole sections of just brand names that just assault the dreamer, right? That are just embedded in there. And the reason why they get in there is because they're designed in a certain way. They are designed to penetrate deep into the unconscious. And this is, you know, I don't know if he's necessarily condemning it as good or bad, but he gives it its rightful place and almost a subtle dominance to that dream that is Finnegan's Wake. It's quite brilliant.
I mean, it is the same thing that the great artist does, you know, because the great, I mean, you can, people may respect Beethoven for his genius, but what they remember is the jingle.
Right.
Bum, 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 bum. Uh-huh. Okay. and it's the same thing. You know, what people remember from the great, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. There's your, you know, your opening sentence or your closing stanza or your chorus or whatever, you know, to be or not to be. All of these things are great art that does find that hook that gets into your subconscious. And advertising just takes that and uses it. You could say that a lot of the people who are the great advertisers would be great artists if they were willing not to take a paycheck.
Right.
It's really just advertisers are way better paid generally in their time for using the exact same talents that a Joyce or a Shakespeare or a Beethoven uses.
Like there's a scene, and we're not going down more into the Mad Men row, but just one scene that caught my eye recently is Draper's wife is redecorating the living room into a more modern middle 60s kind of thing. And she's paying this decorator to do the decorating. And they're going to do this big reveal for Don to see where all his money went. And he looks over the room and the decorator is saying, blah, 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 this. What do you think? And he's silent for a while. And he just says, move that table over here. And that's good. And then he leaves the room. And the wife looks at the decorator with, like, what an asshole. And she's just studying what he's suggesting. And she goes, you know, he's right. Because Draper is a man of vision. He does have vision into a poetic arrangement or an artistic bent. But he's pouring all that talent into advertising. And it's killing him. Because it's just... devouring his connection to an organic world. He's just pumping out good news. All of advertising is just all good news. Good news. It's always going to tell you that there's a way to make things better.
It's invoking a succubus.
Okay.
Literally. Well, I mean, that's what the substitute reality is. It drains the energy. And so, like, with depleting reserves, because initially you get a reward, and then it depletes. At least that's the idea that's proposed around the nature of a succubus. And so if you're taking a logo, which is a sigil, you're in, like, literally invoking an entity of sorts through the power of the mind, like you're creating it, that thing will end up taking from you in the end. And so that's how I look at the whole show. And that's what it seems like they're indicating on the occult side of it, like is just literally what's happening. Cause they're invoking something and then having to deal with the repercussions of that.
Right. And doing that. And that's what the reason I think it's a really sinky show is, the way that anything you put a timeline to, it's like why the Kubrick timeline works and why these, you know, these different, that's one of the games that I like to play, you know, like with Rosemary's White Album, looking at the timeline for Polanski and Lennon, Polanski and the Beatles, and then Rose and Mia Farrow and everyone who's involved and then around that time, if you look at the timeline around that movie, interesting stuff comes up. And I feel like Mad Men is that, because all of this is happening in the context of these historical movements and events that we all have relation to, whether it's the Beatles coming to New York City or the Kennedy assassination or the Martin Luther King assassination or just the popularity of, you know, or different elections or aligning this story with actual context is where you get synced. Because your Kennedy assassination is different than my Kennedy assassination, and we're all watching a story that we can agree, because unlike the Kennedy assassination, there is a right Mad Men. It's the final edit. It's what the artist put on the page or on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
But what's cool about it is by tethering it to time, it means that we all have this other sink outside of it that is very real for us.
Yeah, it's why it works better than Game of Thrones.
Right. I agree. There's a sentence, there's a whole meme about that. Boardwalk, Mad Men or Game of Thrones. And most of my friends like Game of Thrones more, but they're idiots, so. So yeah, sorry.
Most of my friends like Katy Perry, but there it is.
I don't know Katy Perry. I don't know.
I don't either. I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Oh, you're joking. Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't catch that.
I don't think I've ever heard a Katy Perry song, and if I have, I didn't know I did.
Yeah.
Oh, you have, because it's everywhere. You walk into any place in that incredible robotic hypnotic beat is just, and that synthesized voice drives me crazy.
You know what would be interesting is you could take, a bunch of songs from all these artists like Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Nicki Minaj, and all those stuff. If you took out the vocals and you just had a radio station play just the background tracks, it would be very difficult to assign a certain artist to the certain track, I think.
Impossible.
Right.
It's all written by the same computer anyway.
Well, there you go. Not so much in the 60s or the 70s. You could tell a Led Zeppelin song from a Rolling Stone song in a minute. Because there's actually...
Oh, I know. That's always the first... Yeah.
Something could be communicated. Something's being communicated through the music of it. It's not just the message. And that's sort of where I get upset, right?
Now, it's funny. I definitely appreciate this. Like, there's a T-shirt and bumper sticker I see a lot around town that says "Drum machines have no soul."
Mm-hmm. I disagree with that.
It's funny because I've been thinking about this on a whole other level, on a personal enjoyment level. I agree with a lot of this, and like I said, I don't enjoy a lot of modern pop music, but I don't know, it got me thinking in a whole other direction, like this, seeing this bumper sticker, thinking about how and all this sort of stuff, and like what does it mean to be artificially intelligent and all this sort of stuff. It's inspired me on a whole other level to think about these concepts. But I just want to throw out here there's an old Carol like essay. That clock tower is intense.
It is 12 noon.
High
noon.
Time for the shootout.
Showdown.
There's this Lewis Carroll essay/fiction thing where he writes. So Lewis Carroll, aside from being like a poet and a mathematician and all this sort of stuff, he was also a big photography buff. And he had this thing about, if you to take the right photograph and then to apply the right chemical composition to it to make your photo just the right way, it completely changed the artistry of it. And there was all these other layers that you had to be familiar with and that you had control over, et cetera, et cetera. And he's basically, like, I believe, if I remember right, he's lambasting, like, a particular photography method as being so advanced, and we would think it's highly primitive, but so advanced that it strips all the artistry out of photography, and that basically... with each level of technological advancement, you're losing a layer of the artistry. And it's funny because even in that, you can sort of see the hypocrisy of, well, you have the camera in itself is a layer of technology. But like, in that sense, you should have to sit there with a pencil and a piece of paper and recreate that image. But, or is that pencil technology? At what point do you draw that line? And it's just something that's always been very interesting to me, because I can see both sides of that argument, And nonetheless, it's sort of like it's a self-defeating argument, because at each layer that we've added something, there is a blessing and a curse inherent in it.
Sure. Yeah, you know what? I'll go to festivals. There's an annual one that I go to that's like 3 days of electronic music, and there's like the fucking cutting edge of like counterculture and like what is actually our counterculture right now, and like that's I've been at events and been like, this is fucking it, because this is like there is something major happening here, because like with music, like, you don't get the impression of what's actually the innovations that are actually happening with music through anything mainstream. You don't get to hear that. There's no like MTV or any of that, and it didn't. It's true that it didn't used to be that way, because what was cutting edge was what was popular. What is popular is not cutting edge. But it's also popular within communities. It's popular within cities. It's not presented as what's popular through the media, and that's should be obvious enough, and people should be aware of that. But it is really, if anybody gets the chance to go, you know, to certain, it's tricky because you got to know which ones to go to, because there's some shitty enormous festivals. Probably most of them are shitty. But
which one is the one you're talking about? So
Raindance Camp Out. Also Burning Man. There's a couple. Camps, sound camps at Burning Man that are literally giving you the cutting edge of what's happening with music today.
What do you think of Beloved?
What's that?
Have you heard of Beloved?
I have.
It's one that the people in the Northwest love.
Yeah, I don't know enough about. I've heard that. I can't tell you what I really think because I haven't heard enough. But yeah, it's just there's a lot of people out there that are doing fucking incredible music. Just so there's no question as to that, because of the impression that we get through the media. I've seen it. I know it. You know, yeah. There's really incredible shit going on.
Yes, and I'll tell you, and speaking of being a grumpy old man, Bill, I listen to it. I'm just, because I feel like I agree with you. Like, there's a part of it that's like, okay, well, I've been there and I've done, or I'm not a young kid anymore getting excited about this thing. And for me, I can't help but hear it as R2-D2 music. You know, it's just like bleeps and blops, and even sometimes I'll be at events where it sounds good, and I get, and here's the thing, I get that I'm not hip enough to get it anymore, because I still want to hear drums and a backbeat. I want, like, I really do want to hear the personality of the musician recorded on.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about. Not just strictly electronic, where people are taking actual instruments and incorporating electronic into it and doing like complex rhythm structures that are not like oomph, 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 but are like super dynamic and shifting and moving and doing all kinds of crazy shit. And they got the fucking violin out, or they got all these different things like that they're incorporating into it, and like whole bands like creating stuff with an electronic side to it, but then organic at the
same
time.
Come on, you're just describing who's next.
I'm describing fucking like a continuation of what Pink Floyd was. Because Pink Floyd is an electronic music pioneer.
Right.
Let's be very clear about that. Like, and people at the time were like, this is too electronic. And it's like, dude, like, and they're like, this is too loud, this is too whatever. And like, I'm saying that there's people making actual compositions that are utilizing what you can do with drum machines, and like they're making drum machines all the time that are, and people are syncopating multiple drum machines, and they're so fucking busy with like a long table with all of these devices and multiple people working together to create something on the spot. Like, that's like, yeah, I'm just making a simple point that there's really, really cool shit going on. Yeah.
Awesome.
That is awesome. Here in Port Johnson, we just have a lot of buskers downtown, and I go down and they just sing and play, and it's like so old, it's so old fashioned. And some of these people, these are all like kids, they're like 20 or so, and they're just awesome. They're so good. It's like the exact opposite. It's funny.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's everything's happening all at once, all the time, you know?
Yeah, I think that goes to the initial point you were making, David, which is that there was a time when what was cutting edge was what was popular. And in fact, there was something that was kind of oppressive about that. If you weren't one of the 10, 20 or whatever, 40 bands that had had viable record deals or directors who had viable movie deals, like if you had the genius of Stanley Kubrick for making films, but not for making savvy deals, you could get shut out of that and there was no opportunity. Or if your stuff was at odds with what was popular, if you were doing interesting folk music in the, you know, and you were at the right, you were ripe to be doing interesting folk music at the time when the psychedelic revolution was happening, Richard Thompson had to wait like 20 years to have a career.
Yeah.
Whereas with the internet, you can have a huge festival with tens of thousands of people there and a band and all bands that get no radio play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No one knew a lot of the bands that were at Woodstock before Woodstock. Like they did in their areas, but they pulled these people out because they were huge in their areas. Like a lot of these people weren't signed. They got signed as a result of Woodstock. That's what put them on the map. And that's what's happening with Burning Man. It's because people will play at Burning Man. No one knows who the fuck they are except in their areas. And then they get recognized. It's like the equivalent of scouts, basically, because people are going around and they're getting to take in somebody who's only played 100 people at a time is now getting the opportunity to play for 3,000 people all at once for the first time ever. And then it's like, holy shit, what is this? This is awesome. This is different, you know? And then they get recognition, you know? Interesting.
I got to back up here. I'm sorry to be this guy, but what bands were at Woodstock that weren't already signed?
I saw not the Woodstock documentary, but I saw another documentary on Woodstock a while back, and named a list of them. There's a number of them.
I mean, I'm looking at them. They're all pretty, you know, Melanie, Joan Baez, Arlo Guthrie, Richie Havens, Sly and the Family Stone, John Sebastian, Sha Na Na, Canned Heat, Creedence Clearwater, Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, Santana.
It's 1969.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Obviously.
In 1969, all those bands had, like, that's, I'm just want to, there is a difference.
I am not pulling this out of the air. There's a lot of bands that played at Woodstock. There was three days there. So
I know, I'm looking, like, I'm just telling you that at the time, this is the difference of the media landscape now. You could not, like, maybe Sweetwater didn't have a deal. The band closed on Friday night, but all those bands, this is the difference. They were regional and they had deals. The band were already a band. Joe Cocker had a deal in England, was a little thing in England, and he got huge playing in stock. That's the difference, is that all those bands, like there was this, the bands that got played at Woodstock, the people who booked them went to the general bookers. They were the people playing at the Fillmore and the Avalon and playing at, you know, playing at the, whatever the Roadhouse or the Roundhouse.
You can hear Crosby, Stills and Nash say they've never played a big show before.
Yeah. But they were a super group and they had already come out. They already had their deal. They were all, you know, they were all
Crosby,
veterans.
Crosby, Stills and Nash was a super group in 1969.
Yes. David Crosby was the star of the Birds. Stephen Stills was the star of Buffalo Springfield and Graham Nash was the star of the Hollies. They were huge and they were hanging out with Joni Mitchell in California. And they were a band that got signed based upon their reputations and playing songs at parties.
Mm-hmm. I would actually consider Crosby, Stills, and Nash the first super group.
Pre-1969?
Yeah.
What year? I mean, 67?
No, they were a super group in the sense that they were put together out of the stars of three other popular groups.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, he's saying,
they were
Crosby
three
was
things.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, that makes
sense. The Birds was a big thing. The Hollies was a big thing. Buffalo Springfield was a big thing.
Right.
And then they took the big players from those three bands, decided to go off and do their own thing.
All right. Well,
it's like the Who had never had a hit in America, but they had toured America. They were a phenomenon in England, and Woodstock put them over the top in America. Woodstock and Tommy, and that's what happened for a lot of those bands. The thing is that people don't understand about that time in the culture was that bands that had like we think of the Who as being a successful, like my generation as being a successful song. They were a band that had a deal and a budget behind them and minor hits. And none of those things were that wasn't where pop culture was at. In 1969, the center of pop culture wasn't all of these bands. These were on the periphery, and only the kids or the hipsters or whatever who were into that music knew about it. And that was, you know, Woodstock was sort of like Jaws was for films. It was the first of these massive things that took what was an interesting little pop phenomenon and blew it up huge. And looking back, we can see all of those bands leading towards getting huge. And we think of it as if they, but it wasn't until 69 that they were huge, but they were all successful as musicians.
Right. But it put them over the top. And how successful were a lot of them? I mean, I don't know. That's a question. I had heard that, and I retained it. But I mean, I didn't just make that up. I mean, somebody was saying that there were specific deals that got made right after Woodstock for a number of people that, like, that's what put them big time on the map. Like,
there were a couple. There may have been. I'm just saying the majority of the bands that were there, I hate to be arguing this point, but it's when you say that a bunch of bands got signed out of Woodstock, it gives the impression that a lot of people, the mistaken impression that I think a lot of people have about Woodstock was that it was just, that it wasn't a massive business phenomenon that was using the record, that utilized the record industry where it was at. Almost all of those bands were signed, had singles, had records out. It's like, you don't bring an unknown artist on Jimmy Kimmel. You bring an artist who has a record to promote.
David, was there any chance that maybe this was a documentary on the Monterey Pop Festival?
No, it was Woodstock. Okay. But I have seen that, though. I've seen a documentary on that, too.
And again, same thing with those. This is the thing. At that time, those bands all had deals. They just were... They could have had bad deals. They could have not had that platform to promote themselves. It's just as someone who's a musician, and that, like, the difference between being signed and unsigned has changed drastically from before I was in the game, during the time that I was very much in the game, and now. And so it's just that particular phrase, as opposed to saying that Woodstock did launch almost all of them. Like, the majority of the world wouldn't have known who Sly and the Family Stone were if it hadn't been for Woodstock. But they still would have been successful in Oakland.
Right. I mean, they didn't know that many people were going to show up. And that's,
right.
I mean, you could argue that there was a conspiracy and that they had planned that it would ultimately be a free event and they would remove the fences and whatnot. But that doesn't seem like the case. So,
no, I think conspiracy happened after the fact.
Right. And then you have the same thing like with Burning Man. It was that they didn't, I mean, no one could have predicted that it would have become what it is. Like, they showed up in the desert to be away from everything, you know? Like, that's why they went out there, was to get away from everything and to just, you know, like Amy and I, we just went to Joshua Tree. And we went to this town called Pioneer Town where they used to film old westerns. And, like, just because somebody told us about it at a hot spring, we show up there and they're like, there's this venue here that we have shows, like, all the time. And you might want to check and see if there's a show happening. And so we go to this venue. This is, like, out in fucking nowhere, right? And, like, there's, like, the saloon and this, like, outdoor area. And we're talking to people and it's like, no, they've been doing shows there since 1972. and they've had some of the biggest fucking names go through there because this is a like a safe haven for musicians to not have to deal with the bullshit that they usually have to deal with when they do shows. Because this is like total psychedelic central, like, and people live in this town. Like, it's not just like a set. It's like people are living in these old Western houses, and it's like, you know, all these weirdos show up to these shows from out in the middle of nowhere. And like, we listen to this crazy, like, electronic witch music, it's like I've never heard before. This Canadian band, this woman was just, it was fucking awesome and great. Like, you know, like whole setup, what they did was just incredible. But it was like, I don't know exactly why I'm communicating this, but I feel like it's applicable on some level. It's just that this was such a incredible deal to be removed from all of the hype bullshit. Like, just music. Just give us the music in a setting that's just like open and free. And that's why people went out to Woodstock, is that they wanted to experience. And it's funny because it was that, even though it was huge. And so it's the bigger that something gets, the more it tends to lose touch with that thing that people crave, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, I believe that Woodstock was a genuine phenomenon. I mean, it's sort of like WTO. It was the WTO protests. Like, occasionally everyone shows up. Like, mostly nobody shows up. And then occasionally everyone shows up. And usually when it happens, the people who put it on are completely caught off guard. Because, you know, they're used to putting on shows where you don't quite fill the house, or you don't fill the house at all. Or putting on protests where nobody comes. And then sometimes the stars align. Mm-hmm. Or other things align too.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were a hip at all in New York and you saw that bill, for Woodstock in 1969, and you saw that Hendrix and The Who and The Band and Creedence and, you know, I'm just looking at the sort of more obvious ones that maybe people would have known. Jefferson Airplane and, you know, and this stuff's all on the radio at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I would have tried to be there.
The Doors turned it down. Doors were offered to play at Woodstock, and they were like, "No, thank you," which is weird, but I get it.
Well, that's where that's what is it? August of '69 wasn't Jim Morrison? Hadn't he already been busted?
You mean New Haven? You mean
yeah?
I don't know if the Miami incident happened in like 19. 19- One, I think something. I forget. I should know that, but I don't. Hi, Michael. We lost you for a second.
Yeah, hi.
You know who did go to Woodstock?
Who's that?
Charlie Manson.
Well,
he would have had a way better time.
That's true. That's really why everything happened the way that it did, was his resentment for not making it to Woodstock.
It was his protest against the Beatles not doing Woodstock.
Well, you know, there's an element with all of this simultaneously where there is like a high degree of a certain form of fascism in the scene, as it were. And like, there is, I don't remember exactly how it was phrased earlier in this conversation, but I think it was you, Andras, maybe, who was saying that that what was like in terms of that was popular was what got airtime, and what's popular still gets airtime, but like everybody was into it. It wasn't like there wasn't this divide like there is now, as far as young people go.
Yeah.
As far as older people go, that's a different story, but just like, and there's younger people are very divided on how they feel about popular music today. Everybody fucking loved the Beatles for the most part. Like, when the Beatles were around, it's not like that
anymore. Or if you didn't love the Beatles, you loved the Stones. It was like there just wasn't such a diversity.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so there is a certain form of fascism that actually kind of came with that, because the scene, to be hip in the scene, it's like it's so you know what I'm saying? Like when there's like a certain critical mass of what happens to people who aren't participating in the critical mass, there's like a attitude and a hierarchy and all of this shit comes along with that. And
like
so,
totalitarianism, do you mean?
Yeah, in a sense. Like,
because I think of fascism as simply the connection of government with capitalism.
It's like another version of the same thing that's like in the midst of everything. It's not like
Mussolini said that fascism would be better termed corporatism because it was corporate control of the government. And I think what you're trying to get at is that there's a corporate power structure of who owns the radio stations, who owns the record companies.
Is that what you're saying, David? I feel like you're saying that just from on the street, that if there's a homogeny of what is cool, then that creates natural in and out groups. And so I get what you're saying.
Mainly what I was referring to and what you just said, Alan, would be an extension of that or vice versa.
Right. I know. I totally get that point. And I think that's very true. I mean, it's one of the things that, like, we see now with the internet as one of the major factors, that people can get into so many different musical niches that you have, in one respect, it's a nice decentralization of popular music because there are so many different things you can get into. And at the same time, those little cliques just turn their own little demagogic sects, you know, where you have, if you're going to be into the rockabilly scene, they have their own in and out group. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you've got to deal with all that anyway, no matter how big or how small the thing is.
But I think it's interesting, like, you look in our history, like, we're going to talk about music for a moment, like, the idea of Pela or something, right? So we've had instances where this has become, you know, widely known and deemed unacceptable. And then we had, again, in, I believe it was the late 90s, there was a sort of repeat of that, of the pay-for-play, like, again, outrage. And this is happening sort of in tandem with the Napster boom.
Sure.
And this seems to me, you know, I would have to check the actual chronology of it, but it seems like there was a... it's like we talk about, you know, a Dionysian or Apollonian... sort of dichotomy emerging in tandem. It's like the more you try and control the system, the more a counterculture seems to want to rise up. And again, they can be just as quickly co-opted, I think, is a major thing we have to contend with. But that it seems like there's a... Every time something tries to be homogenized, there's a natural tendency to want to break out of that. And then as soon as something tries to break out of it, there's a natural tendency for that to become homogenized.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's the reality of it.
Well, it's synthesis.
I mean, don't we kind of hope that we get co-opted?
What's that?
I mean, from the... Just... Aren't we kind of hoping that, like, just bring it back home to us? Aren't we kind of hoping that we get co-opted? I mean, wouldn't you like it if... Maybe not necessarily you, but one of your authors got successful enough so that we sold 100,000 copies of the Sync book rather than 1,000 copies.
Yeah, exactly. That's.
I mean, I think we all. Again, this is the part of like co-opting just means getting paid for what you do in America, especially if you're an artist.
Well, I guess I'm using the word co-opting as saying like. It's the difference between if you have an established work and then there's suddenly an interest in it and you could sell a bunch of copies that we could support this endeavor, hell yeah. And then there's the difference between that and saying like, all right, you know, we're going to put the Sync book on the New York Times bestsellers list if you put the Pepsi logo on the cover or something. You know, it's like, at what point do you retain control?
I'll say it like, well, what if this? what if it gets successful and you want to, then you want to go and you're going to go and speak at some, someone invites you to go speak about Sync at a conference that you don't have any part of putting together, but you walk out on stage and there's all the logos around you. Are you going to turn say, nah, forget the money you paid me. I'm going to go home. I'm not going to be on stage with this. Or are you going to be on stage with this? And then we're going to say those of us, like not us, but the next version of us will look at those of us who are on that stage and say, look at how Sync Book got totally co-opted.
Look at those sellouts. They got all those Pepsi logos behind them. Yeah.
Right. And it's just like, sorry, it's like blaming a fish for being in the ocean.